it's kind of obvious these days that although there's a vocalized desire for unity, it is being denied us. Perhaps not because of a lack of trying, but because the direction home is clouded. With her book, Wild Mercy, Mirabai Starr is shining a light. This intro and interview is from 2019. Upon re-listening, I felt it is still quite relevant today and timely in the sense that our next tributaries will feature another healer, humanitarian, and world peace leader, author Maya Tiwari, both beautiful women on parallel paths. This is Robin with Tributaries. Join us. Mirabai, hi, and thanks so much for joining us on Tributaries.
Thank you, Robin, for having me.
Leaving home at 14 for the Lama Foundation is a unique experience. How did you happen upon this decision?
Wow, that's an interesting question to launch into, and I love it. Well, you know, I am a product of the counterculture of the 1970s. Well, I was born in 61, but in 72, my family uprooted us from suburban Long Island, New York, and we set out on this kind of odyssey. It was that whole wave of consciousness around the Vietnam War and alternative living. And we ended up, after a year of traveling and living in Mexico, we ended up in the mountains of northern New Mexico in Taos, which was a real crossroads for a lot of sort of consciousness-raising activities and communities. And Lama Foundation is very close to Taos. And they ran, at the time, the school that I went to, the alternative school that my siblings and I went to. And I just kind of fell in love with the spiritual life at 14 and ended up being invited to come live at Lama, where I had been spending a lot of time. And that really opened the door to a whole life of swimming in multiple spiritual waters.
Yes. Well, how did that experience help bring you to learn to, as you put it, walk as a feminine mystic in this world?
Well, I think that it was natural for me to draw the nectar from all of these different religions and spiritual traditions. And what I noticed was really missing from a lifetime of studying and really practicing in all of these different sacred spaces or holy communities was the feminine. Like all of these beautiful world religious traditions and wisdom traditions seem to be lacking access to the feminine. Not only did I have difficulty finding women mystics and saints and theologians, but actually the wisdom teachings themselves in all of these different religions seem to be really dominated by a masculine paradigm. Things like purification and perfection in the spiritual life and transcending this world in order to get beyond this world, seeing the body and the earth in some ways as an illusion, to be transcended, to break through to some more true realm of awareness, and that God was beyond everything we could see and feel and experience as humans, and except through rigorous religious disciplines and so on. So I've noticed that there was a lack of women wisdom figures to look to, and the very structures of religion were so masculine dominated and didn't really fit the feminine experience. And so I began to really start excavating. I felt like a spiritual archaeologist looking for the feminine wisdom teachings and teachers. And so I started teaching online courses, and it just, one thing led to another, and it was just time to do a book. You know, all my books are kind of on the mystics, but I didn't even notice how much my own work was dominated by the masculine teachings. And so it was time to do a book about the women. And I noticed when I reviewed the literature out there that most of the books about feminine wisdom, and there are many, were one particular religious or spiritual tradition. My work is not only not rooted in a single tradition, it's drawing from them all, from many of them anyway, but it's also beyond religion. I'm not that interested in upholding or recapitulating the masculine-based religious institutions. I'm looking at the feminine experience, which is less rigid, less identified with particular institutions.
Well, what makes a mystic? I would imagine if someone reached that space, or however you want to put it, became a mystic, it really is beyond a masculine feminine.
Right. I get asked that question a lot, and it's a valid question. And you're absolutely right. If we would define a mystical experience as an experience of union with the divine, which is the classic kind of academic definition, a mystic is one who attains union with the divine, or a direct experience of the sacred. That's another definition of mysticism, that it's a direct experience rather than mediated through a particular ritual or belief system of any kind. It's a personal, intimate experience of the beloved is what the term is in so many religious traditions. So you're absolutely right. When we get to that unitive state of consciousness, it certainly transcends all dualities, masculine and feminine, among them. However, what I'm interested in is the fact that the feminine is, as I have been saying, so buried and marginalized and silenced in the world's religious traditions. And there are all of these wondrous women out there who have experienced that, those states of ecstatic union and also painful longing with and for the divine, and they express it with such power in fact that reading the poetry of the mystics, for instance, really changes us. It has a kind of transformational effect if we take it in. And so I'm sharing those teachings and teachers and poets and ecstatics and in hopes that it will open our hearts to a different way of experiencing the human longing for intimacy with the divine.
And you do talk in your book about being wise in all the ways you've internalized 5,000 years of values that benefited men over women. Can you share an essence of the occurring shift, or perhaps ways in how the subtlety keeps us closed off?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think that one of the main differences between the masculine and feminine ways of experiencing spiritual awakening, spiritual connection, is the difference between embodiment and transcendence. How all of these religious traditions kind of encourage us, as I said earlier, to see the body and the world as this limited place of awareness, dualistic, and so on, and that true awakening means the dissolving of all distinctions and kind of merging into the one, which is a beautiful thing, and I think my soul longs for that too. But the feminine has a different way in to that non-dual space of unitive love, and her way is the way of embodiment, of claiming this world, of reclaiming these bodies as holy, as not obstacles on the path to enlightenment, but actually the very vessel through which the sacred pours itself into this world and the portal through which we attain those moments of union when our own sense of self as a separate being kind of dissolves and melts into into the one. And so the feminine does it through embodiment, not through getting away from all of this, but through fully inhabiting it, dropping into it, claiming it, celebrating it. Now, I have to say that when I speak about the feminine and the masculine, I am not speaking only about women and men, because there are plenty of women who are quite comfortable in those masculine paradigms, and there are many men, especially now more than ever, who are really getting the feminine path of embodiment and intimacy. So it's the feminine and masculine in women, men, and people of all genders.
There's a point where it is myopic to look at it from a masculine and feminine viewpoint. I had to laugh at myself when I was writing a question. I wrote, in the imbalance of calling it a masculine rule, is it also just a rung on the ladder that collectively we are moving beyond? And then I had to laugh at myself by even calling it a rung on a ladder, because that's suggesting a continuance to a loftier height, right? It's
right.
And it's not that. So
well
it is
done,
such
Robin.
So it is such a subtle thing that we all either personally or collectively are catching on to more and more nowadays, it seems.
I think spiritually, you're so right, and spiritually we're inhabiting a whole spectrum of spirituality, just as we are as a human community starting to inhabit more and more a spectrum of gender. You know, that, and in some ways you could see that as an evolutionary trajectory moving more and more toward androgyny, both in terms of human sexuality and also religion and spirituality. So maybe I think you're onto something there. And I'm really delighted that you caught yourself in that latter image, because that's actually a perfect example of what I began to uncover in my own and inner investigations as well as my research. And that is, like, I think about two people who perfectly embody this difference. And they are two mystics that are very dear to me, St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila.
Oh, that was my next question.
Oh, really?
Good.
They're both 16th century Spanish mystics who I had the great privilege of translating. My first few books were all translations of St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross. And John speaks about a ladder of love that we ascend up and out of this world, beyond this world. And he describes each of the 10 rungs of the ladder. And it's very beautiful, and the last ladder is union with God. And Teresa speaks of the soul as being this rounded palace, the interior castle, she calls it, that is inside of us, and that the journey to union with the beloved is one of more and more deeply entering into our own selves. And it's like just a beautiful expression of that difference between masculine spirituality and feminine spirituality. He's going up and out, and she's going more and more deeply in to this sort of womb-like center.
Yes.
Of the soul.
Yes, and I love the opposing processes of both.
Mm-hmm.
And one is not wrong, you know, it's a perspective that leads to the same thing. You know, years ago when I learned polarity therapy, I learned it from my teacher, and then I got Randolph Stone's books, and oh my gosh, the mental gymnastics and mountains he climbed through his own intellect to get to the energy work was just, it was definitely not my mind, you know, it was his mind, but what an incredible healer he was. And
yeah.
And so the process, and just, you know, earlier you were speaking about the androgyny of it all, but what a beauty of a woman, what a beauty of a man, or the masculine or the feminine. Mm. And that's what is perhaps getting lost as this feminist ideology or way of being is coming out. You know, it's getting lost in the same thing that masculinity got lost in, I think.
Yeah. It's definitely in danger of doing so. And I have to watch myself. You know, I'm just coming. I'm in the middle of a book tour, and so I'm speaking a lot to, and larger and larger groups are gathering, coalescing around this book. I think it's really kind of striking a chord in the collective consciousness about the rising of feminine wisdom. But I even have to watch it in myself, the ways in which I'm tempted to get, I don't know, crustated around or fixated on feminist spirituality, as you say, as an ideology, rather than a lived experience that continually invites me to drop my preconceptions.
Yes.
And allow myself to not know, but to abide in the mystery, and the mystery of love, rather than blaming the patriarchy for everything that's wrong.
Yes, that's really not the direction to go in. And since we are speaking about Teresa of Avila, I love the quote that you write in the book about the important thing is not to think much, but to love much. And so to do whatever best awakens you to love. I mean, when I read that, I thought, that might go on a card for my granddaughter's graduation. It's good advice, right? And so what is it about Teresa, perhaps in a little more depth, about why you loved her? And that could feed into, of course, of why is she remembered, for instance?
Why is she remembered?
Yes.
Did you? Mm-hmm, yes. Well, she's my girl. Santa Teresa de Avila has been with me for a long time through really difficult periods in my life. Great loss, for instance. Somehow she has been a companion for me. In fact, I feel in many ways like there is this invisible net of women mystics and ancestors and spirits that are really upholding me all the time, but especially in stepping into this work of feminine mysticism right now, and she's like the chief of that group. She is, what I love so much about Santa Teresa is that she is this beautiful balance of ecstatic mystic and super practical human being. So she is known for all of her raptures and ecstasies and outpourings of love and longing for God. And she also founded 17 convents and monasteries throughout Spain, where she traveled by donkey cart over these rough roads to personally help create each of these communities, and designed them architecturally as businesses. She was a psychotherapist, in the sense that she was continuously dealing with the psychological and emotional issues that arise when people live in community. She very skillfully navigated the Spanish Inquisition that was always after her, trying to take her down, and ultimately she managed to completely charm the inquisitors, and they fully supported her work by the end. And all of this sort of practical skill was for her an expression of her love for God. It was all completely intertwined. There was no difference between the inner life and the way that gets expressed in community and service in the world. Like the line between action and contemplation was completely blurred, as it is for so many of you who are listening. There is no longer a distinction for many of us between cultivating the inner life and offering those fruits in service to the world. Like, of course, what else would you do? Private salvation, in fact, the whole notion of personal enlightenment is not really, doesn't make sense to the feminine. The feminine is so much about interbeing and recognizing and living the truth of interconnection and interbeing. So that personal development, spiritual development, can only be a container for stepping up and offering ourselves to the world. And Teresa was was really a great example of that. Her reform movement, all these convents and monasteries that she founded, it was part of her attempt to reform the Catholic Church from the being so mired in ritual and rules and regulations and dogma and how things look.
Right.
And she was really interested in returning everyone to the center of their own being, to a life of contemplative practice and silence and prayer, but also celebration.
Right, yes. I interviewed someone one time, and I feel like it's one of my very favorite answers to a question. He was purporting that he attained enlightenment at some point, and so I thought, okay, well, what did you do then? You know, it was mm-hmm. like, and he said, I started getting up earlier, and I just thought, what a perfect answer. Because what do you do? You recognize there's more and more and more to do here.
Yeah, that is a great answer.
Yeah. Well, so much of spirituality is written symbolically. And I'm wondering, how do you see that, or how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think those symbols become the openings to that which transcends the symbols. You know, in Buddhism, they talk about the finger pointing at the moon. All of these teachings and things are fingers that point at the moon, and we're not supposed to look at the finger. We're supposed to look at what the finger is pointing to. And so I love mystical poetry for that reason. It gives you the energy to look at the moon. It's when you read these long prose treatises, theology, self-help books, all of these kinds of things, there is this intellectual quality that in discursive prose that I think can get us caught. And we slog through it trying to get to the essence. Whereas poetry is evocative. It distills it all in symbols and in metaphors to its essence, and we drink of that essence, and that transforms our consciousness and opens our hearts. So poetry can actually give us a mystical experience. And the feminine poet, well, all the poets, I think of Rumi as the great Sufi mystic, 12th century, 13th century, I guess, as a feminine mystic in a man's body. You know, he has that capacity through metaphor, through symbols in his poetry, wine and gardens and fire, all of these kinds of evocative symbols. His poetry has the power to actually leave us breathless and longing for union ourselves.
Yes.
That powerful feminine poetry. My namesake, Mirabai, who also happened to be a 16th century poet, but in India, had that similar power through imagery, like the peacock opening its tail in the rain and dancing to describe, you know, union with God, and so many other evocative images. You know, she, through her ecstatic, rhapsodic love poetry, devotional poetry written to Krishna, the god of love, it does something to us.
Right, yes. And Mirabai, to quote from your book, Wild Mercy, the contemplative life is not for the timid. What stands out to you to make it a rigorous lifestyle?
Right. In some ways, it's so much easier to just buy into an existing belief system and series of rules and regulations in existing institutionalized religions, to just do what they say and believe as they direct us to believe and not question it. But the way of the mystic, which is the contemplative way, contemplative simply meaning being present for what is, and allowing ourselves to kind of sink into the present moment with the fullness of our being, or as Richard Rohr says, to to live a contemplative eyes is, I mean, life is to look through the eyes of love and to see love. This is the way of the mystic. It's a way of being present to what is and finding the sacred in any given moment. And that requires a kind of vigilance. And it requires a willingness, it demands a willingness to not know or to unknow what we think we know, to drop our preconceptions and be with what is. And that takes certain kind of soul courage, you know, to be present to what is rather than the way we think things should be. And to keep being available to the presence of love in all circumstances. That takes tremendous fierceness, kind of discipline, but not a masculine white-knuckled discipline, but rather the practice of presence.
I haven't mentioned the subtitle to your book, which is Living the Fierce and Tender Wisdom of the Women Mystics. And using fierce and tender for wisdom is really it in a nutshell. And one might wonder, well, how can those both be the same? But they are.
They are, especially in a feminine container that's vast enough to hold seemingly contradictory propositions, but they're actually, they create a more vast and truer truth.
Yes, and a greater wisdom, certainly, yes. I would like to ask you if you would read a quote from your book.
Here, this is from the invitational opening section. The secret is out. The celebration is overflowing its banks. The joy is becoming too great to contain. The pain has grown too urgent to ignore. The earth is cracking open, and the women are rising from our hiding places and spilling onto the streets, lifting the suffering into our arms, demanding justice from the tyrants, pushing on the patriarchy, and activating a paradigm shift such as the world has never seen.
A poetic book as well.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Mirabai Starr. For anything we do here, you can reach us at tributariesradio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.